Schrödinger people, and there will be no equation, linear or non-linear, in this talk. There will be, on the other hand, geometric measure theory. Let me start with the last talk yesterday, Ranan Shul's talk about relation of harmonic analysis and geometry. And if you were present, you remember that the second part of the talk was totally devoted to so-called uniform Richter availability, and it was on this Alpher's regular sets. And however, it often happens that you don't have any Alpher's regularity. And a very, very simple example is what I'm going to talk about. So let us start with seemingly a very simple problem. So we consider just a polynomial and its logarithmic derivative, which is just the sum and then you're interested in the level set of this logarithmic derivative. And you want to measure it somehow. There are, of course, millions of ways of measure a set on the plane, but let us use one of the simplest, which is Hausdorff content. So what is the Hausdorff content?
The same P as polynomial?
Oh, no. That's bad. Okay, so what is Hausdorff content? Just if you have a function which behaves like that, near zero, and the set, you just write that MH of E, simply the infimum of sums of HRIs, such that some balls of radius RI cover the set E. So you just take this infimum. So that's Hausdorff content. And if this H of T is just power function, T to the beta, I will just write here the exponent beta. So in this case, what we are doing, we are looking for the most economical way to cover this level set by the disks, in a way to minimize the sum of radii of these disks. And so now I'm doing with history, which is in 1940, when McIntyre and Fuchs consider this problem where there is absolute value inside. And they wrote the estimate, which is C, then N divided by P, C is just absolute constant, and then the number of charges. And they also proved that this is a sharp estimate and asked the question, what will be happening if you put absolute value here and the set becomes smaller, so estimate should be better, though they suggested that this logarithm will disappear. Well, in I think 1968, Marstrand constructed ZIs such that the projection and on a certain line of this set was of the order So this, of course, disproves the conjecture of McIntyre and Fuchs. And so the question remained open, strangely enough, till 2005, when it was completely settled in the paper of Vladimir of Milne-Anderson, Vladimir Edermann. So they proved this estimate with the correct behavior of all constants. And here is the right estimate, and it's sharp. So, first of all, they obtained all kinds of other estimates where you replace the gauge function h of t equals t by whatever you want. It's not so important because the technique was, but on the other hand, it was important that technique was waiting till 2005. Because in the heart of this technique was, if you allow me to use this very general term, was so-called non-homogeneous harmonic analysis. In particular, there will be a certain small part of this non-homogeneous harmonic analysis, but let me tell you what it is, because we will need a bigger part. So non-homogeneous harmonic analysis is the following. You work with your preferred singular kernel on the space L2 mu, where mu is not Lebesgue measure and very, very far from Lebesgue measure. It should be some awful measure. So to have an example, it can be, first of all, the dimension of this measure can be much smaller than d. It can be any number between 0 and d. But also it can be located on basically arbitrary set. So the one of the examples so mu is just Hausdorff measure of dimension s on any set E, which just allows this measure to be finite and positive. So let me remind you again that yesterday we saw such sets satisfying Alpher's David regularity, which meant that this measure at least has doubling condition, and why I'm mentioning that, because for example, if you want to repeat the Calderon-Zygmund theory on such spaces, and you have plenty of kernels, for example, you can consider the following kernel here, xi, so I from 1 to d. So it's a kernel, it's a vector kernel, but it's not so serious that it's vector. It's no problem. It's a Calderon-Zygmund kernel of singularity s, so this measure should be kind of well fitted to it. And you want to construct the theory of Calderon-Zygmund. And for example, you want that this operator is bounded here, then it's bounded in a weak sense. So well, how for example this weak boundedness work if you have already L2 boundedness? You have Calderon-Zygmund decomposition. You break you take these cubes which are in Calderon-Zygmund decomposition, and then you break your function to what? To function restricted to double cubes, and the rest and then you, in this weak type estimate, you kind of nonchalantly use doubling of measure, that the volume of the double cube is the same as the volume of the cube. So nothing like that will work in the in non-alphas regular situation. So, of course, this makes this statement suspicious. Maybe it's wrong that if you have this operator bounded on such space, let it now put E, which is inside RT here, then it's bounded in this sense. However, that's a true statement. So that's true. So bounded here, but to prove it, you shouldn't use Calderon-Zygmund decomposition, but you should use something different. Well, anyway, what it has to do with this problem? This problem has to do with L2 theory, and now our set E and measure are on the complex plane. And the most important ingredient in this proof of Anderson and Adermann was the so-called Melnikov's formula. Formula about Menger's curvature. So it's an absolutely wonderful observation made by Mark Melnikov, which played a huge role in the development of this non-homogeneous harmonic analysis, but on the plane. Because it turns out that this miraculous formula is a plane formula. So it's just a formula. I will write it wrongly. I will cheat you, but I don't want to go into details, and especially this formula in this cheating way is extremely beautiful. So. So here is the formula. First of all, what is R? R we saw yesterday. It's the Menger's curvature. Just the radius of the circle which passes through zeta, z, and w. And this is a kind of Menger's curvature of measure. Maybe just average over all possible triples. And especially if you take a square root, it will be Menger's curvature of the measure. And miraculous here is that if you just open the brackets, you will get some horrible and completely uninteresting complex expression. And suddenly it turns out to be, after averaging, the same as positive. So you can replace a complex kernel by a positive kernel. And this helps a lot, because operators with positive kernels are much better than singular operators. And so this miraculous thing was crucial for this proof. And nothing like that. By the way, what is this kernel? 1 over z? It's one of those which I wrote already on the blackboard, because it's x1 squared plus x2 squared plus I x2 x1 squared plus x2 squared, where z is x1 plus I x2. So it's one of these kernels kx for the special case b equals 2, s equals 1. And instead of writing it in the vector way, we write it as a complex number, especially because in most of our cases we'll apply it to real measures. and then it doesn't matter. It's cheating because this thing doesn't make any sense. So the left hand, right hand side at least is maybe infinite, but at least it has sense. The left hand side doesn't make any sense because you start with zeta on the support of mu, and you finish with zeta on the support of mu. And then what does it mean? Okay, so anyway, what I said so far, that there exists some theory of singular kernels on more or less arbitrary sets, or basically I should say arbitrary sets, and the theory of Cauchy kernel on arbitrary set is a particular case of that. So where is this arbitrary set in here? So one more remark. So if you want to do the same trick with any other kernel except this special case, and even if you make the right meaning of that, you never had this formula. So it's not like nobody knows how to write this formula. It's that it's proved that it doesn't have anything like that. So, for example, what is this question in more general terms? You just have a logarithmic potential of finitely many charges. Logarithmic potential of finitely many charges, and then you take the gradient of this logarithmic potential, and then you try to find the good estimate for the level set. So the same, of course, can be done in RD, because now you just take the combination of fundamental solutions of the Laplacian, like logarithmic kernels, then you take gradient, an absolute value. Well, gradient is a vector, so you should understand absolute value is a norm, where it's bigger than p, and you want to the sharp estimate. Now the gauge function should be n t to the n minus 1, like for n d, excuse me, it's d. So we're in RD. So this is the question. The Laplacian of this thing is just the kernel which I already wrote there. It's X. So this is the kernel. So we have the sum x minus yi to the power n to the power d capital N, and we want to see where this vector is bigger than p. And again, you can replace here d by any power. Like instead of 1 plus d minus 1, you can write 1 plus s. But then here you can write ms. That will be, actually here you can write anything, but ms would be the most difficult, normal, and interesting. First of all, the difficulty. The difficulty that there is no such formula which was used here in this proof. And this is not something like to say about this very easily, because here is the problem: the theory of this non-homogeneous operators on the plane is pretty much finished. So almost everything is known. Almost every basically all problems are solved. As soon as you move to R3, most of things are not known. And the only reason they are not known, because there is no this thing, there is no connection between analysis and geometry. And so it would be very interesting to find any kind of substitute of this formula which will work in space. And this, I think, is the most interesting part of one of them, of what we were doing, that we kind of found something which replaces this Menger's curvature, at least for the goals of this problem. So let me now tell you that part of what I'm talking about is joint with Vladimir Adermann and the part with Fedya Nazarov. So first of all, theorems. Theorems are completely, fortunately, natural. So you have so same kind of estimate, CD. And they are sharp. Let me try to show you how these results are obtained and what they are about. So the proof consists of, say, three parts. So let me formulate these three parts. So suppose we have a measure in RD which has this estimate. And we have any, and another measure is another complex valued measure. And I need one notation which let me introduce. RS nu is the convolution of this kernel with measure nu. So, for example, if we're on the plane and d and s is 1, it's a convolution with Cauchy kernel. So, first of all, it's not quite clear where it's well, of course, it's defined M Lebesgue measure almost everywhere in RD. But I want the following. I want to introduce a kind of a maximal function. What does it mean, the maximal function? The maximal function means that you integrate and you want to target it at point x. So you integrate over all y's such that y minus x is bigger than epsilon. Take norm and then take supremum over epsilon. So then it's defined in every point in RD, maybe infinity, but it's defined everywhere. So it's a singular maximal function, and a theorem says that if you have such a measure and another measure, then the set where this singular maximal function is bigger than t is bounded by a constant which depends only on dimensions divided by t and multiplied by the norm what does it mean? What I wrote here? What I wrote here is actually a sort of replacement of the curvature. So we don't have anything like this formula here. Instead, we do the following. We consider our singular kernel, and we apply it to f d mu with input from L2 mu. And then we consider it as an operator. So we try to measure the norm. Well, divided by the norm of f, L2 mu, and this is, take supremum, and this is the norm. No, it should be mu. And so first of all, I should care about definition, because I will have the same difficulty. The typical example is just s equals 1, and we are on the plane. Then this r is just Cauchy integral. And here I explain that I cannot even apply Cauchy integral to the simplest function f equals to 1. Okay, so even to write down what it means, you should first of all work a little bit. But actually, it's really easy to explain. Instead of such operators, you consider, again, cutting off the singularity by epsilon, and the norm is the supremum over all epsilons of norms of this cut-off epsilon operators. Excuse me?
What's mu?
Mu is absolutely any complex measure. Yeah, so here it's A, some constant, divided by T times the norm of the operator. So let's think what it means. Suppose we are in RD, and our S is also equal to D, and our measure is just the Lebesgue measure. So then it just says that if operator, Calderon-Zygmund operator, is bounded in L2 with respect to Lebesgue measure, then applied to any complex measure, it will have weak type estimate.
How do you normalize?
Oh, yeah, I forgot. Yeah, this is sorry. Okay, so all right, so this is theorem one. Theorem one is actually very natural. It just says that if you have bounded an L2 operator, then you have the same operator working from L1 to L1 weak, but you can even replace L1 by measures. That's it. So that's completely standard. Non-standard is, of course, the proof, because you cannot have double balls or whatever. You cannot use doubling theory. So theorem two is again a sort of kind of ramification of this thing which we lack. So because this estimate involves the estimate of the norm of the operator, it would be nice to be able to compute this norm, or at least to estimate. And here is the theorem. And here I will write Thank you. So here is the estimate of the norm of our operator. Okay, so now to finish, for example, such an estimate, which, by the way, let me maybe mention that you shouldn't have all weights, all charges once. You can put any charges, and only here you should replace it by sum of absolute values of charges, of course. So to apply it to prove this theorem, we already have measure nu. So measure nu is no problem. So where is measure mu? So this measure mu is the following. Theorem 3. Okay, so there exists positive measure mu. Let me denote. Well, it's okay. It will be clear. Such that it has the following properties: that support of mu lies in the set so what does it mean? It means exactly that the Cauchy, not Cauchy, this Riesz transform of measure nu is bigger than P, but also you can write this as a Riesz transform of measure nu, right? You can write it as R S nu, but then you even add star, so the set becomes bigger. So actually we are having a slightly better theorems. Instead of writing where this thing is bigger than P, we're writing where this star is bigger than P. So the second property is that mass of mu is equivalent with two absolute constants to M whatever S of Z star. And the third property is that measure BXR is less than R to the S. This is just a certain kind of combinatorial statement. So you need to construct a certain measure, and what you are doing is, of course, you are looking at this set where at the level set, and so it looks maybe a little bit awful. And you kind of try to correctly choose some disks whose number will be at most n, where n is the number of points, and kind of correctly combinatorially choose them in such a way that just the surface measure, in the case of, say, S equals D minus 1, has this property. So it's a certain combinatorial construction of this measure. So as soon as you get that, you are done, because you just combine all these three things, and they come out exactly with this result, with square root of logarithm n, which is not very difficult to see where we get it, because if you do a little bit of work and integrate here correctly, it will be like integral from n to 1, so logarithm n will appear here. Here is square, so it will be square root of logarithm n. It will appear over there in theorem 1, and then you just get this. So let me elaborate a little bit about that, because here we clearly can formulate what we are doing in a more neatly, in a neater way. Let me say that we are trying to prove some isoperimetric inequalities. So for simplicity, I will work on the plane, but absolutely the same thing works in RG. And so I will call picture, or actually n picture. So n picture is just the collection of disks on the plane with the following properties. So this is one property. And the second one I will say in a second. But what we want now to do, we would like to minimize. We would like to minimize so-called gamma of this picture. So what is this gamma? Gamma is on the plane, it will be analytic capacity. In space, it will be some other capacity. So what is gamma of the set E? Gamma of the set, there are many different definitions. Let me write the definition which imitates potential theory. So it's supremum of norm positive measures on E such that So you just try to find out how much measure you can put on your set such that the Cauchy transform would be bounded everywhere. So you can, replacing this transform by any of our kernels, we have all this gamma S D capacities. As soon as you come to RD, replace it by another singular kernel, you have a capacity. A capacity is not really... You see, the one of the huge problems in analysis, which was solved very recently, was to prove that this capacity is capacity, at least in this very weak sense, that it has semi-additivity of this type. If you consider the standard capacities, for example, put absolute value inside, such properties become trivial. Why? Because there is always a dual definition of capacity where supremum is replaced by infimum. And then just by trivial consideration, you get semi-additivity. Well, there is no definition, as far as I know, of this. Well, since there is, but it's extremely fancy, and this proof is extremely difficult. And so this is Torf's proof. So this is what I want to minimize. I want to consider this isoperimetric problem, but you see, gamma is always smaller than diameter of the set. And so put like that, it becomes a little bit stupid without second condition, because you can just consider balls of radius 1 over n and put this pattern of disks as close to, oh, of course, 0 is disjoint. You put them as close as possible, then how much they will cover, there, this is the area, this is how many of them. So you can put them into the disk of radius square root of n, and you know it will be the best configuration, and you get that this is of the order 1 over square root of n. So this is stupid. This is not what we want. What we want to add another condition. we want to add another condition, and this condition that these disks are already kind of so to exclude that, that these disks are already kind of independent, that M1 of the union, so they are already kind of their own best covering. You cannot improve too much M1. So let's put here some absolute constant, which you can take, for example, 1 over 100. So this thing is called PN picture. And what we try to do is to minimize that. And actually, it's exactly what we were doing in this lemma, in this theorem 3, in this combinatorial part, but under another disguise. So that's one is a parametric inequality, which is an interesting, and of course the answer is known now to us. So let it be theorem 4, and you can guess that this minimum of gamma on pictures is equivalent with two absolute constant logarithm n, and the same will be if you are in RD and you consider n spheres. So this is actually the essence of the proof of our estimates. Just to kind of try to make you feel what it means and what is this all talk about. So consider unit square and say n disks of radius 1 over n in it, and put just their surface length measure, so this will be m, and try to estimate what is the norm of the operator which has this kernel from L to M to L to M. So the thing is that you should assume that M1 of the union of your disks, which is of course smaller than 1 because they're in scale 1, is also bigger than 1. And then just try to estimate the norm of this operator. But for any pattern with this condition. And, well, working a little bit, you will see that it's exactly norm is exactly not bigger than square root of logarithm n. And there is a pattern for which it's bigger than constant times square root of logarithm n. And what is this pattern? And this pattern is this pretty famous set from which I probably should have started. So you take your unit square and then find the centers of this disk up to small, well, up to nothing, like that. So you consider this squares of side 1/4 and repeat this procedure, throwing away everything else. So we're constructing 1/4 counter set for n generations. So you get 4 to the small n number of squares of sides 4 to the minus n. So think that the squares are disks. And this will be the thing where this norm is bigger. So that's kind of give you the estimate from below from this minimum. So we see that these isoperimetric patterns, and the same happens in space. Isoperimetric patterns are patterns of the sort of counterset patterns of this point z1, z2, zn, etc. And let me now mention, just to finish, that there is a very much related another set function, another functional, which is extremely closely related to gamma, but which is the beast from geometric measure theory. So you consider not the gamma, which is actually even not so easy to explain, even though I gave a formal definition, but before needle probability. So this is easy to explain. You just take any line, project, measure the length, and then average over all lines of this length. So it's another interesting isoperimetric problem, and the answer here is also known, and it's 1 over logarithm n. The thing which is not known, whether this particular picture is also extremal. So the BU of this nth generation counterset, 1/4 counterset, has been estimated by different people, by Solanac and Perez, by Terry Tao, and finally by joint work of Fedya Nazarov, Yuval Peres, and myself. But instead of being kind of equivalent to logarithm n, we can prove that it's less or equal than 1/6 power of logarithm n, and that's a little bit short of 1/logarithm n. On the other hand, the estimate from the other side is really very easy, and the conjecture is that actually it's equivalent. And so you can say, how do I know that it's actually 1/logarithm n here? I know it because, so one side is probably old theorem that for Kakeya sets on the plane, which look at n directions, you cannot get the area of the union of these strips better than 1/logarithm n. So it's one in one direction. And another direction, that there is a Kakeya set which gives that, actually gives us the pattern of disks, which will be extremal. So that's how I know that this is sharp. So let me finish by saying that in principle the relationship between gamma and BU is very enigmatic. There is very interesting things happening between them, but nobody really knows what really happens, and such kind of examples give us a little bit of knowledge. Excuse me? Theorem 2 is supposed to be, yeah, Theorem 2 is exactly supposed to be like Melnikov's formula. The difference is that Melnikov's is sort of this. That's the question. Exactly the question. No, it's not true. Morally, yes, but it's still not true. But the funny thing is that what you should do. So how it is proved? It's proved by trick. It's proved by trick with these complex kernels that after some symmetrization of this complex kernel becomes positive. And the only step which was needed here is that to do the same thing and not be afraid that they will not become positive, because anyway there will be a cancellation. So the observation that if you make the same thing, the cancellation still helps you, and you get this estimate from above. On the other hand, this is extremely powerful because it has estimates from below also, because this is positive. And this is lacking. So it just then you may ask next question, how it happens that you have sharpness if you have in one direction only and in the other direction it's lacking. Well, the thing is that on counter patterns, it is really equivalent. So if you have some geometry, underlying geometry, then it becomes equivalent. So that's the answer.